Welcome to this podcast of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club of California, by and for people in their 20s and 30s, with a mission to inspire debate around civic issues. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at www.commonwealthclub.org/Inforum. You can also find Inforum on Facebook, MySpace, and LinkedIn.
Tonight, for Afghanistan, the New Iraq, we'll hear the inside scoop on U.S. efforts in Afghanistan. President Barack Obama has already pledged to send more troops into Afghanistan and is now in the midst of hearing from military commanders and advisors about how best to proceed. Even though we may be more immediately worried about our pocketbooks, we cannot ignore the world around us, so let's have a discussion with experts on Afghan politics, society, and culture about the implications of U.S. foreign policies. And I'm going to start with a pretty basic question. Will U.S. forces ever get Osama bin Laden? So I forgot to introduce everybody, because this is my first time ever moderating. This is Sophie Delaunay. She's the executive director of Doctors Without Borders. And before joining Médecins Sans Frontières, Sophie led several humanitarian assistance programs in countries diverse as China and Rwanda, working to bring impartial medical relief to people trapped in war-torn regions around the world. Fariba Banawa is an award-winning Afghan-American journalist. She has a new book deal, by the way. She's excited about it with HarperCollins. She covers a range of issues and specializes in immigrant and Muslim communities in the U.S. and abroad. She lived and reported from Afghanistan from 2002 to 2007, and she was evicted from Pakistan? Is that the way to put it?
Deported.
Deported. Okay. Shara Joshi is a postdoctoral fellow at the Center for Nonproliferation Studies at the Monterey Institute of International Studies. He focuses on security issues in South Asia, especially nuclear proliferation and terrorism. So I cheated myself by starting with the question, but I'll start with you. Will we ever get Osama bin Laden?
Yes, I suppose at some point, I think the only way he can cheat this is by, if he succumbs to his various ailments. But I think a larger question is, how important is it? Because his role has obviously changed in the last 7 or 8 years. We do see various reports and analyses talking about how his role is now more of a figurehead, more of an icon who's supposed to inspire newer recruits and provide more funds. So it's more of a, he is more of an icon and a figurehead rather than someone who is in direct, who is on top of the decision-making structure, which leads to insurgency and violence in the Afghanistan and Pakistan area. So the short answer is yes. I mean, at some point I would think so, because there is more and more pressure on Pakistan also to increase its military operations on the Pakistan side of the border. So, I mean, assuming that they're able to squeeze from both sides, in the sense that you have U.S. and Afghan forces on the from the Afghanistan side of the border and Pakistani forces from the other side, I would think at some point, yes.
Any disagreement?
I don't know if it's a disagreement. I don't think we want to catch him, because he gives us the reason to continue fighting there. I think he's a figurehead for us too, which is, it started out with the Bush administration, which was the ultimate evil, and I think he continues to be that. I don't think that Obama's administration is going to make him the good guy anytime soon. And I'm not sure that they're looking for him anymore, as far as I know. So if he turns up, he turns up. If not, it's not really a priority.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, one of the things that, I mean, we talk about Osama bin Laden, there's also a lot of suffering going on in the country with civilians. Sophie, can you, I know that Doctors Without Borders left Afghanistan. Can you talk about why you did that? And
Yeah, first of all, if I may also add my comment to your first question, I don't know if we'll catch Osama bin Laden, but what I know for sure is that as the conflict is escalating in the area, both in Afghanistan and in Pakistan, the population will continue to pay a heavy cost with this conflict. So the humanitarian consequences will be absolutely dramatic. Now, why did our organization left Afghanistan? We've been working in Afghanistan providing assistance for 24 years, actually, since 1979, since the Soviet influence. And then, so, you know, we've witnessed the civil wars, the Soviet occupation, the civil wars, then the Taliban regime, and the beginning of the war with the United States. And we left in 2004 because in June 2004, five of our colleagues were assassinated in Afghanistan. It's not the first time that we lose volunteers. We know we are working in situations of war, and we know it's risky and dangerous, but for the first time we were targeted. And for the first time, we also face a government who showed no will to prosecute the perpetrators. So it was becoming too risky for our staff to, you know, you can't decide to save life on one hand and lose the life of other on the other hand. So this is the reason why we left Afghanistan.
And do you see any, is it possible that you'll be back?
Of course, we would like to go back because we know that the needs are immense. At the moment, we are exploring possibilities to go back, but we want to have some guarantees that our staff, I mean, zero risk does not exist, but at least that we can operate in an independent and impartial way without being killed.
During the 2008 election, during the Democratic primary, President Obama talked about he was against the surge in Iraq, but he supported a surge of U.S. troops in Afghanistan. I think a lot of voters looked at the war in Afghanistan as the good war, and the war in Iraq as the bad war. I'm not saying I agreed with that, but I think a lot of people looked at it that way. What do you think, Sharad?
The war in Iraq, obviously, was the elective war, while to use academic jargon, the Afghan war was the more compulsory, the more core war, obviously. So to that extent, yes, I mean, I agree with that. The war in Iraq was definitely an elective war. But the way we see Afghanistan right now, and frankly, I would prefer to see Afghanistan and Pakistan as, you know, a more coordinated, comprehensive kind of issue rather than just Afghanistan. And this is something that the Obama administration has caught on to. Also, you know, we have a new addition to the security lexicon, the AFPAC strategy, which is supposed to be a more coordinated approach. So it's not just a case of, you know, just surging ahead with the increased troops, because even in Iraq, it wasn't just a case of increasing troops by massive amounts. The strategy involved a lot of other steps also, you know, drawing in other tribes, providing more money to the militias so that they had less of an incentive to engage in insurgent violence. So that is the sort of template that they're looking at in the Afghan context also. I mean, there are important differences. I mean, you can't just... it's not necessary that you have to learn lessons from one conflict and apply them to the other. There are obviously differences between various regions. But the basic template remains the same. You have a surge of troops. You increase troops. I think by the end of the year, there should be about 30,000 more U.S. troops, and hopefully there'll be more troops from other countries. But at the same time, as we've been reading in the papers, they're looking at drawing more and more of the moderate Taliban elements to the extent that they exist. Now, there are important differences over here. I mean, I think it will be a lot more difficult to draw in Taliban leaders and Taliban groups than it was in Iraq, there were important structural differences because of which certain groups were more amenable to being drawn into the U.S. scheme of things. I don't think that's all that possible in the Afghanistan-Pakistan context. And in this, and here it's important to consider the whole AFPAC element of the strategy, which is that you can't really have an effective strategy in Afghanistan unless you consider what's going on across the border.
I guess maybe the short question is: Can NATO trips win? Is this a winnable war?
I think it's more of a manageable kind of conflict. It depends on how you define winnable. Troops are required at least to provide some degree of stability so that other humanitarian development operations can begin, can persist for a while. So in that context, troops are important. But they're obviously not the main solution.
The only solution is a political solution.
So the way I see it, you need more troops, preferably Afghan troops, but that's not going to happen for a while. And then in coordination with that, you have other political activities, whether it's talking to certain elements of the Taliban or other groups like Gulbuddin Hikmatyar's group to the extent that they are minimal, or any other groups. But we also have to consider that there are certain elements from the traditional Taliban who will not come around to the table. So I don't think it's possible for all elements of the Taliban to come to the table.
Fariba, I keep seeing on talk shows talk about the moderate Taliban. Can you tell me who the moderate Taliban are?
There was a guy who went to Yale. He was part of the moderate Taliban. He was kicked out after an article in the New York Times magazine came out. His name was Rahimullah. And I interviewed him when he came here. It was during the time when they blew up the Buddha statue. And I don't know if many people know this, but there was a big debate before that that blowout amongst the Taliban themselves, and that was a fight between the moderate and the extremist elements. And actually, from my information, Osama bin Laden was the one who had ordered that.
It was
one of the biggest Buddha statues in the world.
And what's the name of it again?
Bamiyan.
It's the Bamiyan Buddha statue.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And at that time, they had sent this young man. He was 24 years old. And groomed him, and they had sent him to the United States for public relations purposes. And at the same time, they blew up the statue of Buddha. So, and he kept telling me that it's not Mullah Omar doing this. And I was trying to find out why are you doing this? Why are you even here when you keep having to? You're not doing very well with your public relations campaign. And he said, well, there are other elements that we don't control. And I think that was the issue, that even the Taliban amongst themselves had these divisions. And so Mutawakkil, who was the foreign minister, he was considered moderate Taliban. And moderate Taliban basically meant they were open to the world. They were open, some of them were even open to letting women go to work and go to school, but they didn't have the power. I think similar to Iran, the conservatives were in power. And the Arabs who lived in Afghanistan at the time and who had a lot of control, this is Osama bin Laden's sort of group. They were quite large and quite powerful at the time. They controlled what happened in many arenas because they were providing a lot of the resources and funding for the Taliban. So I think that the moderate Taliban do exist. Whether we should be talking to them and bringing them into the... I do agree that we should... That is, that I agree with Sharad here that the solution is political and troops aren't going to be the only answer. But we really need to be very careful because if the Taliban come back again the way they were in power before, then you're going to see the same, if not worse, types of humanitarian crisis. And the war, you know, when I spent 7 days in Afghanistan during the Taliban period, I have never seen a people so depressed in my life, especially in Kabul and especially the women, which are half of the population. And I don't think you're going to see any improvements if they come back into power. So I think there has to be agreements made, but there also has to be rules set, defined, about what can and can be allowed in terms of what women are allowed to do, in terms of how we should move forward politically and morally and religiously, because I feel like if the Taliban come back in any way, they're going to start imposing their way of life again.
Sharad?
Correct me if I'm wrong, yeah. I think it's important to also examine some of the structural changes within the broader Taliban network in the last few years, because it's not a homogenous group anymore. You can't really call it one group. It's a network of various groups, militias, on both sides of the border. Now, why this is important for U.S. policy is because one of the trends that you see is that not all elements of the network start as the Taliban. You have various groups which are localized, operating on at least on the Pakistani side of the border, who develop an area of influence in certain villages, towns, in the tribal areas, the Northwest Frontier Province, and then they decide to call themselves the Taliban. Okay, so it's not as if they are starting out as the Taliban. It's because they develop certain a power base, and then they decide, okay, let's step it up, let's go to another level. So that means that they are, you know, open to changing who they are. What they are operating as. At least that's what my opinion is. So they're not starting out as the Taliban. It's something that they get into because of certain benefits that they see. Could be monetary, could be ideological, could be anything.
And Sophie, is there something you wanted to add?
Yeah, we're talking about drawing lessons from Iraq to Afghanistan and from Afghanistan to Pakistan. And I think that Western countries also need to draw lessons from this past experience. My point is that the failures and dangers of our Afghan experience and Iraq experience in mixing humanitarian and military operations are playing out now in Pakistan. The reason why we were targeted in Afghanistan was that there was a blurring line between humanitarian aid and military aid. The reason why in Iraq it's increasingly difficult to operate is because you are perceived as U.S. military when you provide assistance, because the governments pretend to be humanitarian as well. And in Pakistan, the problems we face right now, and in February, two of our staff were killed in similar circumstances, is that most local NGOs, our organization is among the only Western NGO present there, but there are lots of local NGOs funded by the U.S. government and operating in the country. And they are, you know, there is a total distrust of NGOs in this environment, because You can't blame the population, right? The same money which is used to bomb the country is also used to build hospitals and to bring drugs. So it makes it increasingly challenging and difficult for us to reiterate our neutrality and impartiality. And I think that the lessons to be learned by governments is to clearly separate the humanitarian and the military agenda. Everybody's doing its job. And to untie the funding from the humanitarian work.
The Guardian had a piece today in which it reported that all the great minds have decided that Hamid Karzai is going to win the election, and that Western powers are thinking of inserting someone into his administration to clean it up. Is Hamid Karzai going to win the election? We can.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
Me? I hope not. I don't think so, if you ask the people of Afghanistan at this point. I think he started out really well. I think the elections, if you'd done a proper survey in 2004 during the first elections, they did vote for him. However, now there has been so much corruption and lack of leadership that the Afghan people need someone who's more aggressive. And I don't think that Mr. Karzai has got the backbone. And he's in bed with certain people, including his own family, who are not necessarily clean.
Then who will win?
There are several candidates now. And I don't know. I think that's the exciting part about this election. If it does end up being a fair election where each candidate has the right to advertise and is able to campaign freely, then the Afghan people will vote, I think, although there's a lot more apathy now. In 2004, there was a euphoria. I mean, everybody went out to vote. My housekeeper went out to vote. It was a very exciting time. But there is also a lack of understanding of what democracy is. If you go into the villages of Afghanistan, a lot of people don't understand what a president is. They're most familiar with the monarchy in the 1970s, and a lot of them actually support the comeback of the monarchy.
Fariba, a lot of Americans would probably think whoever gets in is going to be corrupt. Is that a fair thing for people to think?
I think you're always going to have some level of corruption, but I think your main leader needs to be not corrupt.
I understand that. I think that's a... I share that sentiment. So who do you think can offer Afghan voters the kind of change that you think they need?
From the candidates that are in power right now, I actually cannot say. I think that would be too much. I don't want to say that publicly right now. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure. Actually, to be honest, I'm not sure who I support right now. But I think there are viable candidates. And I think that there needs to be fair and free campaigning in order for people to decide for themselves who they should vote for.
And do you believe that there will be that kind of campaign there? I mean, with the election in August?
Right? I think that mm-hmm. the main issue is security. Are people going to feel that they're safe going out to the polls and voting for who they really want to vote for? Mm-hmm. And if you can make the arrangements so that people feel somewhat secure, especially in the northern areas, then yes, it is possible to some degree. But in the south, I think that it's going to be very, very difficult.
Sharad?
I read some of the stories that news stories that you just mentioned. Yeah, there was some discussion of some of the Western powers trying to build up a prime minister who could be a counterweight to the president and try to slowly reduce the president to figurehead status. I don't see the situation changing before the August elections.
Mm-hmm.
So we can assume that the current situation is going to continue till August, and there are going to be security problems. I'm not so sure there will be the level of free and fair campaigning that we hope for.
And will Mr. Karzai?
I don't see any other option.
You think that in the end, enough voters will think we may not like him, but he's the best we've got?
Even then, I don't see any other candidate who could be an alternative. So even if people just stay away from the polls, they say there's no point voting. He still might just be the winner. Because I just don't see any other alternative. I mean, there have been a couple of names that have been talked about.
Mm-hmm.
I think the former interior minister, the finance minister. But I'm not so sure they have their own power base or they're powerful enough to challenge Hamid Karzai.
I was in Ireland last month, and a number of Irish people told me how shocked they were that Barack Obama was sending more troops to Afghanistan. I think that they had assumed, because of what he said about Iraq, that wouldn't happen. I mean, they followed the campaign here, they'd know better. Canadians want to pull out. I mean, what happens if non-American NATO troops start pulling out of Afghanistan?
I think they already have started pulling out.
Exactly.
There's been some hope in the last few months that Barack Obama would be able to use his international political capital to get them to, contribute more troops rather than withdraw them. But I don't think anyone's made any commitments so far. Maybe they will at the next NATO summit. I think that's in early April.
Mm-hmm.
So at that time, they might, and they should, frankly. Because if they don't contribute more troops, there's going to be increasing chaos.
I mean, is it possible that we basically have American and British troops there? And what does that do?
Frankly, I mean, it just ensures that the stalemate continues, because even if you assume that the surge is put in place, there's a limit to the amount of troops that can be sent from Iraq to Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
There just aren't enough troops, so other countries have to contribute. whether it's NATO or non-NATO countries, whoever they might be. So troops are essential, you know, to, at least in the short term, to bring in some stability, so then you can go towards other political, economic, developmental approaches.
Fariba, I know you're working on a book on the drug trade. There are libertarians in the United States who think that maybe if we legalize drugs, that would change things in Afghanistan. What do you think?
Afghans would like that too, some of them, especially the traffickers. I don't know that that's a viable solution right now because internationally it's not considered an option. There is a group called the Senless Council who are trying to do that for pharmaceutical purposes. And they've been campaigning really hard in order to have that happen, but they haven't succeeded.
They want a global institution to pay people for opium so that it can be used for medical uses.
Exactly. They want all this poppy farming to be utilized for morphine and codeine and other things, derivatives of opium. However, the government of Afghanistan says that this is not possible because we don't have the structure to guarantee that this can happen. And then if you ask one farm, you know, if you choose three farms, what about the other six farms in the village? Who's going to be the beneficiary? Are you going to be able to buy 8,000 tons of opium for pharmaceutical purposes? So there are practical issues with that are questionable.
Mm-hmm.
So I think legalization is a question that has been thrown around, but it hasn't been figured out yet.
Well, I guess then the other question would be, is the drug war working for... What is the effect of it in Afghanistan? Has it made growing poppies too profitable? What kind of solutions can you see to growing poppies? And I mean, as you know, I mean that's obviously something that's bankrolling the Taliban right now. So
exactly, I think the issue is multifaceted. You can't just look at the drug trade as the drug trade by itself. You have to start looking at it. As the problem began, initially Pakistan was actually growing poppy, and then it was pushed into Afghanistan. And now Pakistan is primary consumer of drug addicts, and so is Iran and the other neighboring Afghan countries. You have to look at security, number one, the police force. I mean, you have elements of the drug trade in the government, and that's one of the main issues right now, is that you have to look down from a top-down approach, but also a multifaceted approach to see what you can do. It is not an easy answer. It's not going to be a quick fix. We can't go around spraying all of the fields in Afghanistan, which is what some congressmen in this country support, and I don't think that that's going to give you the response you want at all. So there's something called alternative livelihoods for farmers, cash for work programs. There is a strategy in place in writing. The problem is implementing it. And I think that the strategy that's in place right now could work if security improves and if we're able to give viable economic opportunities to farmers.
Sophie, what do your people in Pakistan see from the drug war? I mean, what kind of effect does that have on refugees?
It's difficult. Well, the major impact on refugees comes from the war and the violence, and come from the disaster that the very low health indicators in Pakistan. I'm sure that there are consequences of the drug war, but frankly speaking, it's not the major issue for the civilian population. Mm-hmm. For the civilian population, it's hundreds of thousands of people who are displaced constantly because of the violence, who have no water, no shelter, no blanket, no access to medical care, in a country already where a third of the population has no access to drinking water.
And when people come to stay with you, how long are they in a camp?
Well, they are staying in camps, and the camps are moving because of the violence. So people desperately try to find some, either to settle all together in a camp or around Peshawar, they are hosted by families, which makes it better for them, but also more challenging both for the population and for us to reach them. And because of insecurity, it's difficult for them to access health structures and for us to access the population. The problem is especially acute for women because they are already discriminated generally in the process, and they have less access to healthcare than any other in the country. But when it comes to emergency obstetric, and they require vital care that they don't get in these kind of situations. So this is what we are dealing with, providing healthcare, surgical, well-related injuries, and also, you know, trying to organize some ambulance systems so that people can access this kind of care.
Among adult refugees, how many of them are women? How many men do you have who are refugees?
We have. It depends where they come from. If they are internally displaced, you have a similar amount. It's quite equivalent between men and women. But we also have Afghan refugees in Pakistan, especially in Balochistan. There are a lot of Afghan refugees. For those who've been there for a long time, there are more women. But for those who just arrived, usually the refugees, the men come first and the family follow. Mm-hmm. So we have
And where do these? I mean, where do these people end up? Do they assimilate into Pakistan?
Maybe Fariba would have additional information to give. But for some of them have been here for years. Some of them just crossed the border. The situation is so dramatic in Pakistan that some of them also close to Afghanistan. You have to be really desperate to seek refuge in Afghanistan, right? So mm-hmm. It gives you an idea of the situation over there. Mm-hmm.
The question was, where do they end up when they do go to... There are 2 million refugees, as far as I know, in Pakistan. Still, you have some repatriating, but they come right back sometimes. It's a fluid situation. It's in flux. And it depends on the situation, on the current situation in Afghanistan, usually. If there's an earthquake, people are displaced, where do they go? There's no place, no jobs in Afghanistan for them. They go across the border to Pakistan. If somebody gets sick in the family, the health situation in Afghanistan is not appropriate for them, so they go across to Pakistan if they have the money. So you have so many people crossing every day, but those who move there because they can't go back to their village for security reasons or war reasons usually end up with family or on the border areas. Peshawar, the main city in the Northwest Frontier Province, it's part of it was built by Afghans because starting in 1979, You had this exodus of refugees. My own family was there for 2 years before we came to the United States. And so you start making connections in Pakistan, whether it's business, schooling, and there's an entire area which are just Afghans. It's called Hayatabad in Peshawar. So I think that they have made their own mark in Afghanistan. They're not just considered refugees anymore. Mm-hmm. And they've actually been... A percentage of them have been able to move up economically in Pakistan. And I think culturally they've been able to integrate easily because of the religion. It's the same religion as, and in a lot of ways, the same culture. However, I think that the poorest of the poor end up in camps. And these camps are horrible places to be, and they end up living there. And these camps aren't temporary. These camps can last up to 20 years. You're living in a tent. So that's where they end up.
Sharad, we're spending how many billions of dollars a month in Afghanistan right now?
A few billion, I suppose.
A few billion. Now, I mean, it's going to hit $5 billion a month, I would imagine, very soon, correct?
It's going to be a lot more because some of the proposals that have been pushed forward as part of a coordinated Afghanistan-Pakistan strategy, that requires a lot more money. And especially if you're talking about the more economic, developmental kind of aid. So the big item on the agenda is reconstruction opportunity zones, which are certain zones which are established, on both sides of the border in Pakistan as well as in Afghanistan, to to provide an opportunity for people living under the Taliban to have something else, you know. So they have an incentive to make certain products and be assured that there will be a market for those products. So those are the reconstruction opportunity zones that both Afghanistan and Pakistan have been asking for quite some time. But that's going to come with a price, you know. And that's aside from the money that has been promised to Pakistan, you know, mm-hmm. which is more than $1.5 billion a year of non-military aid, you know. So you have to look at the big picture, not just Afghanistan, because now we have a comprehensive strategy.
Well, I ask that because, of course, during the election, we'd often hear about the cost of the Iraq war being $10 billion a month. We're approaching that for the cost in Afghanistan.
Right.
Do you see that as being an issue in Washington, and what effect do you see it having?
It's important in the sense that it fulfills a very key demand of one important constituency, which is, you know, stakeholders in Afghanistan and Pakistan.
Sorry, I didn't hear you.
It fulfills a key demand of one set of important actors, which is stakeholders within Afghanistan and Pakistan. But I'm not. I don't know to the extent to which these proposals have passed through in Congress. I know that the same bill, the Reconstruction Opportunity Zones bill, was introduced last year, about a year ago, and it didn't pass. So I think it has passed. I'm not exactly sure whether it has or not, but I haven't seen it in the news lately, frankly. So my guess is that it really hasn't caught on, that the actual figure hasn't really caught on with the decision makers in Washington, but soon it will be.
Maybe that's a good thing.
Well, it's a good thing if it contributes to some comprehensive and long-lasting solution. If that's what the end result is, fine.
So each one of you has an expertise in this issue and obviously cares a lot about Afghanistan. Sophie, let's start with you. What do you think about the attitude among the Americans you meet about the country, and what do you think people should know that they don't know?
Well, I think that this is an invisible crisis, that a lot of people know about what's going on in Afghanistan and Pakistan, and there is a huge media coverage on Pakistan. Every day in the New York Times, you read one article about Pakistan, but rarely you hear about the human cost. So I think that what we should keep in mind is that we're talking about a war. We're talking about a war. I mean, it sounds a bit naive, but hundreds of thousands of people are paying the price every single day on this war. So just to keep in mind.
How many civilians would your group estimate have died?
Oh, you have to ask the UN for these kind of figures because mm-hmm. they have a broad, you know, vision of what's going on. We're just working in some very, you know, pockets and where the crisis is. So it's very hard.
And
I would say it's hundreds of thousands.
And how many?
Oh, at the moment, there are several hundreds of thousands of people displaced in Pakistan alone. In Afghanistan, I don't know because we're not there anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So just to when I understand that there is these are different agendas, and there are contradicting logic and processes between humanitarian and military. It's not for humanitarian aid workers to decide a hierarchy among humanitarian action, military action, or political one. Of course, from our side, we reflexively tend to give aid priority. But we acknowledge that there are other approaches. What we need first is to have humanitarian agenda and political one separated, and funding should not be mixed between military and humanitarian. This is the most important, to preserve neutral and impartial and safe aid.
Okay. Fariba?
Repeat the question again. Sorry.
What was my question? My question was, what is it that you think people should know about what's happening in Afghanistan, what Americans should know that they don't know?
I think that most Afghans that I talk to support the U.S. presence in Afghanistan right now and have from the beginning. And that I think their main fear is to go back to the Civil War of the 1990s when the Soviets pulled out and the U.S. also pulled out in every way. I think that's the main fear. That was the worst time for most of the country, worse than the Soviet invasion itself, I think. So I think there have been surveys done, and I'm not sure that people are aware of this. They want the U.S. to stay and to build the to help them build the country. And to they basically want assistance, but they don't want to be controlled.
And they're afraid that the U.S. might just pull out.
Yes. I think that that's a fear, that if the soldiers leave and the consultants leave, then it's going to resort back to civil war, or we're going to have the Taliban back. And some of them actually prefer the Taliban to what they have right now, because they did secure the country. There was this one unified voice. However, that shows you how desperate Afghans are, because the Taliban did not provide economic opportunities. They did not provide specific freedoms. I mean, the country had reverted back to medieval times. And although maybe many Afghans in rural parts agree with their way of life or way of thinking, I would say that in the urban centers where progression takes place, they don't. And I don't think, especially women, again, they want to go back to that. So I think it's very important for Americans to know how much Afghans depend on this effort. And the difference between Iraq, I worked in Iraq and I worked in Afghanistan. It's a huge difference. You can't even compare the situation, the terrain, the people. They're both Muslim countries, but that's about where the similarities end. I mean, the tribal structure in Iraq is still there. It's very it's a very successful structure. In Afghanistan, it's been broken apart by years of war. Afghanistan is much less educated than Iraq. The terrain in Afghanistan is rocky mountains, where you have flatlands in Iraq. So you have to think of all the differences before you can compare the two and understand the histories of each country. But I think that it is important for us to understand the distinction between controlling a country and helping a country. And I think that's what Afghans want people to know, is that they don't want to be occupied, and they don't consider the U.S. being there an occupation. Again, from the places that I went to, and I've traveled pretty much everywhere except for the eastern part of the country. But in Iraq, they did consider it an invasion from day one. So that was a big difference in how people think of this intervention, should we say, to keep it neutral.
Okay. Sharon?
I'll just continue on to what you said. And I think the one way to ensure that U.S. forces are not seen as occupiers is to have a regional strategy, because there's no point increasing the number of troops on the Afghan side of the border. There's no point pumping in enormous amounts of money, even if it's for non-military aid, economic development, that sort of thing, unless it's a regional strategy that takes care of what's going on the other side of the border. Because there are important stakeholders on the Pakistani side who may not be so amenable to what U.S. approaches have been and the kind of policies that are being considered by the powers that be in Washington. So I think what needs to be stressed is that there has to be a comprehensive strategy which incorporates both military as well as non-military elements. And I don't think they can function to the exclusion of the other.
Thank you. Now it's time to go to the audience for questions. So I guess people will stand up to the microphones. And, sir, you're the first one to the mic. You get to ask the first question.
Thank you. If I can establish the context for just a minute, you've talked in a rather macro level about the national situation, the presidential election, the ministers, and so forth. But you haven't talked about the villages, and I've read very little on Afghanistan, but I did read the book a couple of years ago about the Brit who walked across Afghanistan right after the Taliban. And that was an entirely different picture than you've drawn. He would go from village to village, and go 20 miles, and there would be no linkage at all. The folks wouldn't understand what the village would be, and he couldn't get from them what he was going to see. So it struck me that there's a great deal of fragmentation across the country that you didn't address tonight. You've been trying to talk to it in a more macro level. So if you would, then, talk about the villages and how they can be incorporated in, and the meaning.
Is that to me?
Sure.
Okay. Yeah, you're talking about Rory Stewart's book, The Places in Between, which is an excellent read, I agree. And he did something that few others have done. It is a fragmented country. It has been always. The center has never had that much control, and that's the part of the problem right now as well. There's always been this constant tension between the rural and the urban, and also the center and wanting to be independent for the various tribes that live there. How can we connect the villages to the center? I think that's one of the main questions that politicians are dealing with. Americans, the Brits, and the Afghan government themselves, and are trying to. I think one of the main answers is the media right now. So I have been. I can only speak to the places that I've been to that I've reported from. There's a province in the northeast called Badakhshan, which is quite removed from the center, and it's primarily supported by the poppy economy. And what I saw there was amazing, because I saw that women were actually, they had better lives because of the poppy trade. And they were able to dress themselves, buy cars for their sons to become taxi drivers and find ways to support themselves through the poppy economy. But the way that they related to the center was through television. They had, in houses I went to up in mountaintops, villages nestled alongside mountaintops where there's nothing. The entire village had one television and one satellite dish.
See, TV can bring communities closer.
Yeah, and that was one way that they could relate to the rest of the country.
We have a very short amount of time, so I'm going to try to quickly move through. And let's try to make these questions short because there are more people here than we have time for. Sir.
Yes, I did a brief comment about the heroism and the exceptional service of Doctors Without Borders. I think it's an extraordinary effort. Now, because of the enormous difference between Iraq and Afghanistan, my understanding is we're not trying to replicate the surge that provided greater security in Iraq, but rather to provide a level of security that will provide an opportunity to train or double the size and then train an efficient army and a police force in Afghanistan. Is that possible? Is there a pool of possible trainees or potential trainees that could form a security force within Afghanistan to bring some lasting measure of security?
Thank you. Good question.
Absolutely. The question is not whether there is a pool. There is a pool, absolutely. The question is whether we have enough time. That is the big question. Because if we need troops in Afghanistan, preferably Afghan troops, police forces, the army, professional trained troops. But we just don't have enough time to do that, because this is not something that you can put in place within a few weeks or even a few months. So that is the big problem. You know, and the fewer foreign multinational troops, the fewer people, the fewer the trainers that you have to provide training to the recruits. So I think it's a question of whether we have enough time, rather than whether there is a pool of. Think of it this way: getting people into the police services, the military, is also one way of lessening the number of recruits available for the Taliban. That shows how important that is. But it's a question of time.
Ma'am.
Going back to the first question that was asked, are there older political structures in the tribal areas that could be gone back to that would help to stabilize the country politically so that people wouldn't say what we hear in the news here, that Hamid Karzai is just the mayor of Kabul and there are all those other people out there who somehow are in some other political situation? How do we use that to come to a political solution, since we all agree that a political solution is what you need.
Okay, don't fight over who gets to answer this. I'll choose. Fariba, it's your turn.
Okay. Yes, there are. And it's called, it's a grand assembly. It's called the Loya Jirga. And you have the elders in the community, whatever communities, usually villages, sit together and make these big decisions. And the women have a say in the house, usually, about that decision. They talk about it. That's what I was surprised about to see. But I think that these systems have been broken down by the 30 years of war, and that's what I meant about Afghanistan and Iraq. I think the tribal structure has suffered, and that's part of the problem, is that you don't have anything coherent anymore that can speak for the entire population to be able to sit down and do this. And the other thing is that you have these warlords who are still in power, and they're armed, and they terrorize people you have a meeting of, if you have civilians come together and meet to talk about an issue, then that warlord in that town is going to influence the decision that is made. So that's one of the problems that you're dealing with the traditional structures.
Sir.
Yes, I just finished reading Three Cups of Tea, and that's why I'm here tonight, to kind of get another insight. What Greg Mortensen has done, he talks a lot about educating the girls, the women in the country. And Margaret Warner was just there on PBS, I guess, for a month, and she was reporting. And I think what she reported was it was only 11% literacy rate among girls or women, I'm not sure what she was saying, in the country. And a lot of the things I'm hearing up here, I guess two questions. One is that it's, at least some of you are saying that, well, the women are doing this and the women are involved in this, and with an 11% literacy rate, I'm not sure how that jives. And then my second question is, we're talking about the military going in there and trying to stabilize the country. How much is the U.S. government, do we know, is also trying to go in and help with the education issues? Because it seems like that seems to be a grounds-up type thing. Thank you.
Sharon? Yes. Sharon, do you have to answer this one?
I think the first question is definitely within your domain.
I take it back.
Thanks. The second question, again, I mean, it's been the policy so far in the last few years has been so chaotic and has been so tactical in nature. It just hasn't been comprehensive enough to incorporate both military as well as economic dimensions. So the economic part, the development, they're obviously trying to increase it. But this is not going to be as effective as you want it to be till the time there is some degree of stability in the villages and in the small towns. That said, the proposals that I've seen so far, they aim to increase the amount of development aid going into both Afghanistan and Pakistan by a large degree. The question is whether that money will be, whether it eventually passes Congress and the other decision makers in Washington. So far, we just haven't seen enough non-military aid flowing into Afghanistan as we would have liked to see. I mean, I forget what the figures are, but the kind of figures that I've seen have just been pretty shocking, frankly. Yeah.
Fariba?
We did Afghanistan on the cheap, and now we regret it. And now we're trying to change it, but in some ways, unfortunately, it is too late. He mentioned that we've got a time issue now. The development issue. As far as the women are concerned, the literacy rate does affect, obviously, decision-making. However, there are women who are educated, who are employed, especially in the cities, Kabul, Herat, Mazar, Jalalabad, you have women out there. I saw something last night. Again, this has to do with the media. The media is making big advancements in Afghanistan. And if there's one thing that has changed during these 8 years, it's the situation. Newspapers, television stations, radio programs, and people are listening and watching throughout the country. So I saw a young woman singing on something called Afghan Star, which is the equivalent of American Idol. And can you even imagine that during the Taliban era? And she wasn't just singing, she was kind of dancing too. And so for me, watching this was shocking, and yet I was so glad. And you know, others in the country will see it, and they will be shocked. And that television station has been threatened many times by many parliamentarians, conservative ones. However, that itself right there shows some type of change that we can say is positive.
I mean, you were working as a reporter and a woman when you were there. Were there special obstacles with which you had to deal?
Oh, where should I start?
I'm allowed to cut in just once.
Yes. I had the biggest issue in Afghanistan for me was being a woman. I could use it to my advantage and disadvantage. The advantage was that I had access to men and women. Rory Stewart's, the problem with his book is that he only talks to one woman throughout his walk across Afghanistan because he's a man. He's a British man. He can't talk to Afghan women without being killed. The limitation is that, you know, you're limited to what you can wear, who you can talk to, who you can interact with. I was threatened many, many times. One of the times was that the children in my neighborhood threatened to throw acid in my face because I had male expatriate men over for dinner several times. That's just one example. So you're constantly negotiating your role as a woman and constantly making decisions on what you should do next. That said, I would go back and report there again because it was the most welcoming country and well, it's my homeland, so I guess I'm not very objective about it. So
okay, thank you. Sir?
I'm an expert on Afghanistan because I read the novel, The Kite Runner.
You know, that's why they asked me to moderate, because I read The Kite Runner, too.
Perfect. But, you know, the Taliban is basically a fundamentalist religion that bans alcohol and et cetera. How do the leaders reconcile their involvement in the drug trade with that type of background? Secondly, an insurgency needs at least the support or the tolerance of the population. And if the Taliban was so oppressive when it was in rule in Afghanistan, how can it expect to succeed as an insurgency?
Okay. Should I address both? Okay. As far as the drug trade is concerned, there seems to be a consensus among most Muslims that I know that alcohol is super evil and drugs are okay. And so as long as you're not smoking them, then it's okay somehow because you're making a living from it. And if you talk to most poppy farmers, they'll say, we have no other option. And in most cases, they don't have as much of a lucrative option as poppy. Poppy is a great crop. It grows in areas where you don't have to have rain. You can make soap out of this. It's multi-useful. So I think that morally, there have been edicts by the scholars, by the ulema in Afghanistan several times, but I don't know how much effect it's having. The second question, as far as the insurgency is concerned, I think that, again, the main issue for most Afghans is security. It's the ability to get out and go to school without feeling like you're going to be shot. So having the school there is important. They do want that, but first they want to feel safe going there. So the Taliban did have that. And in the south and some parts of Afghanistan in the east and even some in the north, I would say, people want them to come back so that they can feel secure again. And everything else is secondary to that. So that's why I think they've been successful as an insurgency, because of that, because of what Afghans remember during their reign. It was that they had that option to go out and feel safe, especially for the men.
Sharon, quickly, because I want to.
I just want to reiterate that point. I mean, a key problem, one of the key reasons why there hasn't been enough support from within the Afghan population for foreign forces has been this feeling that, okay, you guys will come into the village, you know, protect us for a short while, and then you'll go away. And then who are we left with? We're left with the Taliban. Okay. So we have to make a deal or, you know, there really isn't any other option because they don't see the multinational forces as forces that will be around even in the medium term. They'll be around for a few weeks and then they're gone, and that's it. You know?
We have 3 minutes left, so we're going to make this a lightning round. There's three questions left, sir. We can do this. We can get you all in if we do it fast. Sir.
I've read in a number of places over time that there's elements of the Pakistani intelligence services that support elements of the Taliban, My question is two parts. One, is that true? And if it's true, why do they feel it's in their interest to do so?
There's been plenty of documented evidence in recent years. The most recent one, I'll refer you to David Sanger's book, The Inheritance. He's the New York Times reporter, and there he's given several instances. One, for example, at one point when multinational forces were about to attack certain Taliban targets in, I forget whether it was in Afghanistan or within Pakistan's tribal areas, they were informed, they were warned by radio, by elements of the ISI that you're going to be attacked, so you better get out of there. And then there was another instance where the current Pakistan Army chief was heard on radio referring to one of the Taliban leaders, Jalaluddin Haqqani, as a strategic asset. So
and
there
why?
Are plenty of...
Why?
Strategic asset because Pakistan historically has had, strategic objectives in Afghanistan as well as in India. Pakistan sees Afghanistan as part of its as its strategic depth mm-hmm. against any conventional war with India. So it has certain objectives in Afghanistan which have been in place since Pakistan was created. You know, and that is not something that you can break down within a few years of pressurizing Pakistan. That is a mentality that has to be removed. And it cannot be removed by simply replacing the army chief or the president, unless you have elements within the ISI, the mid-ranking elements, the lower-level elements, who've been interacting with the Taliban or people who became the Taliban for the last 20 years.
So we have 1 minute left.
Okay, question about Iran, Russia, and India. Is it in their interest to have a stable Afghanistan, and if so, what role should they play?
We'll give that to Sharon. He doesn't want to answer it. That's why I went to him.
I think all three of them have an interest in a stable Afghanistan, but all three of them also have certain strategic objectives as well, which may not necessarily be in tune with a stable Afghanistan. India has historically has had close ties with certain sections within Afghanistan, especially, you say, the Northern Alliance. Russia, obviously. Iran has had a lot of interest within Afghanistan. The key conundrum is how to get countries like these three to work in parallel rather than at cross purposes, you know. And I mean, for India, the biggest problem is, you know, how do you how to ensure that Afghanistan doesn't become a battleground between India and Pakistan, you know? So they have their own interests as well, which may not run parallel to, you know, the broader objective of a stable Afghanistan.
The woman in purple has been waiting patiently. Last question.
Very, very quickly, briefly, as briefly as you can, for each of you, your comment. Obama's decision to put a lot of money in to send all this, pro or con, given all the history and everything that you've said, good idea, not, don't explain further, we don't have time for it. You've already given the explanation. Okay. It's just your endorsement.
Sophie, do you want to answer that question or not?
Can I answer the question by just one comment, not
okay.
pro or con?
Okay.
I would just ask President Obama, please don't pretend to be humanitarian as you are party to the conflict.
Okay.
Fariba?
I'd like to see what he put his money where his mouth is, and also I want to see what he's talking about implemented. So, yes, I think
that's
we need
pro.
A change.
That's pro.
Pro, yes.
Pro, okay. Sharon?
As long as any strategy is comprehensive and coordinated, and by that I mean both military as well as non-military aspects that cover all parts of the problem rather than piecemeal.
Well, let's give a big hand for our panelists for the thoughts, sharing our thoughts tonight. And thank you for being here for my... Oh, do I gavel? Oh, I get to do it again. Thank you.